What the Health with George Bertineau on FUBAR Radio.
Good morning and welcome to What the Health with me, George Bertineau. This is your weekly dose of no-nonsense fitness and health talk, and I am your host. And I'm going to be here to help navigate the wild world of wellness. If we haven't met before, here is the lowdown. I am a BSc in sports rehabilitation. I've spent 5 years in the world of professional football, and I've been helping everyday people like you make smarter health decisions for over a decade. Each week on What the Health, we cut the noise, the gimmicks, and yes, the internet's endless sea of bullshit. I'll be bringing you some brilliant guests to help break down the fitness trends, debunk common myths, and give you clear, practical advice to smash your health goals the right way. So grab your coffee, your protein shake, or your dog's leash for this morning's walk, and let's get into it. We're going to be joined by Alfie Whittingham, footballer and owner of Elevate Fitness in Winchester, and Dr. Sam Watts, clinician of Ayurvedi and author of The Ayurvedic Approach to Cancer. Now, this week on Mythbusters, we're going to be discussing eye health, and I'm going to be joined by Dr. Dan Ranstein, founder of the London Vision Group and specialist in ophthalmic surgery. Dr. Dan Ranstein, good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Are you well?
I'm doing great. I've just seen my patients from yesterday, and I've dispelled all those myths.
Wonderful. That's what we like to hear. Right, let's jump straight into it. So, how did you first get into the field of laser eye surgery?
Well, first okay, here's what goes into first. You go to medical school. You go through, you know, pharmacology, anatomy, everything. Mm-hmm. You then work in a hospital as a medical student. You then become a doctor. You know, you have to deliver babies. You have to suture, you know, open scalps and casualty. You do your house jobs. You then apply for an ophthalmology specialization program, which is learning how to do eye surgery, just like somebody else would learn how to do neurosurgery. Okay. And then you specialize in eyes, so that takes about 3, 4, 5 years. Then you specialize in cornea, which is the front of the eye, the window at the front. Mm-hmm. And then you specialize in laser eye surgery. So for me, it was something like 18 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite a trajectory. It's basically vision correction surgery is and should be a highly, highly specialized field.
I mean, because our eyes are so important, right? Our vision is so important to us.
Well, our brains are important. Mm-hmm. Our, you know, kidneys are important. But the point is, it's like any other specialty. It's one part of the body, and then actually, even within the eye, we are so specialized that I did do squint surgery, you know, and I treated, you know, cataracts, and I treated, did blepharoplasties and took tumors out, but I specialized in vision correction, which is it's marrying engineering to biology. Mm-hmm. And reshaping the cornea and refocusing the eye.
Amazing. And was there a reason why you wanted to go down laser eye surgery or, you know, vision correction?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I finished medical school, 1989, this was a brand new specialty. It was absolutely, there was nothing even close to it. And that meant that the very, very earliest work was being done. And so a field that has maths and physics, that was for me. I was much more interested in that aspect of studies. Together with it being a surgical specialty, which I wanted to be a surgeon of some kind, mm-hmm. It just seemed like the perfect combination. There is actually a third component, because the two specialties that I went for at the end of medical school, after thinking about everything that I could, I did like everything. I liked obstetrics. I liked everything. But mm-hmm. the two specialties that I thought would be the ones that would keep me interested for the rest of my life,
we'll wet your whistle, yes,
were eye surgery and psychiatry.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I thought, you know, those would keep me interested. And turns out that eye surgery has a lot of psychiatry in it. because you're operating on people who are awake. And, well, basically everyone is anxious, right? There's no such thing as having eye surgery and not being anxious about it, because as you said, sight is, you know, the one sense that everyone says, oh, I could never, you know, lose that. I would rather be deaf, you know, whatever people say.
Yes.
So, you know, having to manage anxiety is really a part of the specialty. Okay. And I always say to people that performing this high precision surgery perfectly every time, over and over again, absolutely perfectly, that's only 50% of my job. The other 50% of my job is managing anxiety.
Yes, as I can imagine. Like, imagine being awake on the table could be quite, quite, you know, anxious-inducing, shall we say, or anxiety-inducing. So what would you say the main things people should know about getting laser eye surgery is? You know, what is it? You've obviously mentioned one, so I'm assuming that you are awake on the table, or you are awake during surgery. But is there anything else? What are the main things?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a field that is, let's say, not that new anymore. There have been something like 60 million procedures already done around the world. There is more than, I don't know, the number of scientific publications in this field is in the tens of thousands. So it's not a new field in any way. We know all about the long-term safety.
Heavily researched.
We know all about, you know, every. So one thing that should be known, for example, is that in terms of the safety of laser eye surgery, it's actually safer now than contact lenses.
Okay.
So that's a quick way of explaining a lot, because people think of it in the terms of what it was like 30 years ago when it started. And when you look, you know, if you were to say, well, you know, those two 737 Maxes that crashed a couple of years ago, right? One in Africa and what was the other one? I can't remember. Within a month, these brand new 727s from Boeing both crashed. Now, you could then say, oh, well, you know, gosh, you know, I'm not going to fly anymore.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Well, it's like, yeah, okay, let's look at the statistics here. And that was human error in programming and in training the pilots. Once that was all realized, they should have done it after the first one, but it took them two. That's never going to happen again.
No.
So in the same way, one can search the internet for laser eye surgery complications without realizing that actually a lot of that data is very old. You know, somebody today who is not doing well with laser eye surgery, apart from it being extremely rare, is fixable. Whereas 30 years ago, if you had a complication, it wasn't fixable. We didn't know enough.
Yeah, it was very new medicine, wasn't
it? So the safety of laser eye surgery is such that, you know, of course, you can wear contact lenses until you're 18 if you don't want to wear glasses. But once you're 18, if you have expert screening, you should have your eyes done. So there's another kind of misconception out there, which is that your eyes have to be stable before having laser eye surgery.
Okay.
And that was true 30 years ago when we didn't know enough about screening. We were trying to screen out diseases that made the prescription worse, upon which we shouldn't do laser eye surgery. But now we are so good at screening those cases out that we can operate on 18-year-olds, you know. And actually, laser eye surgery, once it's done, stabilizes the vision. So rather than wait till your eyes get worse, if you have laser eye surgery, they'll get much less worse than they would have, which is better for the health of the eye.
Yeah, longevity of the eye, yeah.
Someone's a minus 5 at the age of 18, and they have laser eye surgery, and they're minus 6 by the time they're 28. They've gone back minus 1.
Yeah.
Well, if they hadn't had the laser eye surgery, they probably would have gone back to minus 2 or minus 3.
Okay.
the higher the minus, the longer the eye. The longer the eye, the thinner the retina. The thinner the retina, the more likely it is to have breaks in it and get a retinal detachment, which leads to, you know, blindness. Or the more likely you are to get glaucoma, or the more likely you are to get cataracts earlier in life. So diminishing the progression of myopia is important. There are ways of tackling this in children with special drops, special glasses, special contact lenses. But you can actually tackle it in the same way with laser eye surgery. By zeroing out the prescription, the mechanisms for making the myopia worse get subdued. These are just general facts that are quite obvious to us now as experts in this field.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, out on the high street, there's just, you know, a lot of wrong information, a lot of myths.
That's the whole purpose of the show, right? We're here to debunk all of these, you know, wives' tales and bring in the professionals who are, you know, experts in their field. So that's exactly why we're here. So, I mean, we appreciate you going through that. How bad is it to stare at the sun without sunglasses? Is that bad for us?
If it's during the day, you can only look at the sun. Well, as long as you can look at the sun, is totally safe.
Okay.
Because no one can look at the sun during the day for more than a few seconds before their eyes start watering and you have this reflex of shutting and you're tearing.
Because you kind of get this imprint of the sun.
Sun gazing at sunset.
Mm.
So if you've ever been to LA, which is where my mother lives, every single day you get the most gorgeous sunset every day because you're on the west, you've got this open coast, and the sun you can just watch it. You can actually almost see it going down the horizon, you know, red, and then boop, it's gone. That's not good for doing because the infrared that comes out from that sun, because you don't have the white and yellow light, it doesn't dazzle you, but the infrared is still getting through, and your eye is focusing the light right on your retina. That's like a magnifying glass to try and focus it on an insect, like nasty boys do, which I was doing when I was. Did you do that?
I did once or twice to some ants. Yeah.
There you go. So you cook a few ants with the magnifying glass, and that's one of the earliest science experiments known to children. Well, the light from the sun, that infrared, imagine that infrared is being focused right on your retina. And if you look at that for 5, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, actually you can cause damage to the retina. And it can be irreversible.
Okay.
It's called sun gazing, a sun gazing injury.
So you avoid sun gazing.
From that.
Oh, okay. Avoid sun gazing.
Yep, you're taking notes, good.
Yeah, of course, always take notes, okay. And when should people go for eye tests?
Yeah, the rules about eye tests are, they're not enforced sufficiently, is the word I was looking for. So the real deal is you really should have an eye exam before the age of 4. Now, this isn't pushed because if you were to do this for the whole population, then there wouldn't be any money for cancer screening.
Yes, of course.
So this is something that parents should know is something that you need to pay for. Sorry, it's not included in the NHS package. But children under the age of 4 should be screened because if there is an unknown, for example, imbalance, or there's high astigmatism in the eye, which is when the cornea is not round, it's oval, you can actually have underdeveloped brain vision. And if that underdeveloped brain, because the brain has never received a sharp image, so it doesn't have anything to develop on.
Okay.
If you put a kid who's 3 years old with underdeveloped vision in glasses that needs it, they will fully develop their vision. If you catch it after the age of 5 or 6, it's too late, and that's called lazy eye.
Okay.
So the percentage of lazy eye in this country is about 4%. Now it's higher in this country than England than it is in Northern Ireland, even though it's the same country. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because Northern Ireland has instigated a nationwide screening program for children. They've put the money into that. England has separated this off from the NHS and said, no, it's local authorities. And the local authorities have said, we don't have the money, so they don't talk about it.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so that was where I say, like, one of the most important eye screening tests is to take your child to an optometrist, and not just any optometrist. It has to be an optometrist who also sees children.
Okay.
What's the next spot? Next stop is, you know, you can't see the board. Well, you're going to end up with an eye doctor. But let's say you're someone who never needed glasses. The eye is still an organ, and it still needs checking. So the next stop would be in your 20s, regardless of whether you need glasses or not. And that's any optometrist on the high street. Then once in your 30s.
Okay.
And then every 3 years in your 40s, and then every 2 years in your 50s. So why does it accelerate? 50% of glaucoma in this country is undetected.
Mm-hmm.
Glaucoma is a silent blinding disease. 25% of short-sighted people will get glaucoma.
Okay.
And many people who are not short-sighted get it too, but it's really common in short-sighted people.
Okay.
So how do you screen for glaucoma? Not by seeing whether you can see or not. You have to have your pressure measured, probably a visual field test, and a look with machines at the back of the eye to measure the optic nerve, which is part of the brain, which degenerates in glaucoma. And it's silent because it's painless. So people tend to only find out they had glaucoma if they haven't been to an eye doctor, when they, you know, cut the edge of their forehead on the edge of a cupboard because they couldn't see peripherally anymore.
Okay.
Or they have a car accident because they couldn't see a motorcycle coming this way. So that's the recommended rate of eye exams. And it's on the NHS, you know, website,
yep.
But no one reads it. So I'm glad we said this here on the show.
No, and Dr. Dan Ranstein, we've actually run out of time. So I just want to thank you so much for everything, for your in-depth answers. So thank you so much. You have a great, wonderful rest of your day. And we will speak to you very soon, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You take care. Bye-bye.
Anytime. Bye-bye.
Right, guys, coming up after this short break, I'll be joined by Alfie Whittingham, footballer and owner of Elevate Fitness Gym.
FUBAR Radio.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
The lovely Matt Phipps.
Hello. The thing that surprised me most was how much joy I took in being, like, making people feel really uncomfortable. It's so
Amen.
Good. So good.
Your mum jokes change completely.
My friend the other day, she was like, how tall is your mum? And I was like, oh, she's 6 feet under. Yeah, they did not know what to do with that. And then you let it hang in the air.
Yeah.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
when you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
Politics Uncensored.
We kind of act like COVID didn't happen. Well, do you think it's had a lasting impact, at least on that young generation that experienced it?
The legacy of it in schools, you see the legacy of it in people's mental health. We're seeing the legacy of it even in public services, even in hotels, hospitality. Everything was stripped back to the bone, and the UK did not have the resilience to recover. So I think we are still definitely living in a post-COVID society where nothing really works as well as it did. If you think things were damaged by Brexit... Yeah. Things were double damaged by COVID.
Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Danny Harmer, hello.
Thank you, what an introduction.
I heard in an interview, this may no longer be the case, but in 2020 you said you'd never actually read the original Tracy Beaker.
I've still never read it, and I'm gonna go down with this ship, and quite frankly, I shall never read it. I've got this far in life. And do you know what? I think it's kind of, in a weird way, I think it helped me get the part, because I had no idea of this character apart from the character that I made her.
What the Hell with Georges Bertineau, exclusively on FUBAR Radio.
This is What the Health on FUBAR Radio with me, Georges Bertineau. In this week on The Big Topic, I'm joined by Alfie Whittingham, footballer and owner of Elevate Fitness in Winchester. Alfie, hello, good morning, how are you? Alfie, hello, can you hear me? I think we are just having a little bit of a technical issue.
Good morning, George. So, am I live?
Oh, he can hear
us. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Is there a delay?
Well, there must be a delay, mate.
Yeah, I think there's a slight delay. I think we will try the first few questions, and if not, we'll have to move on to some listener questions. Let's see if you can hear me. Can you hear me okay?
What about now, man?
Yeah, seems okay. Right, how did you first get into playing football, Alfie?
Can you hear me, Georges?
No, I think the signal's not great.
I don't know why the delay is so much.
Yeah, well, what we'll do is we'll move on to some list of questions for now, and then we'll see if we can sort out the signal, okay? Right, guys, so David asks, I've been on holiday for the past 2 weeks and haven't been eating currently / working out that much. What is your advice for getting back on track with your fitness goals? I'm feeling unmotivated as I've noticed regression. Right, well, first of all, David, how many holidays do you go on a year? Because if you don't go on very many, then don't worry about it. We all work hard all year, or if we don't, it's not the end of the world. But just remember, holiday is a chance for you to relax, put your feet up and have a break. You are not, by the sounds of it, a competition athlete. You are not a competitor on the bodybuilding stage. You are not a Hyrox athlete. So for me, I wouldn't worry too much. Okay, I would make sure you enjoy your holiday. If you don't want to train whilst you're away, then great. If you don't want to eat on plan, then that's absolutely great. So my advice for you for getting back on track with your fitness goals would definitely be just start going again. Okay, so just start using this nicer weather to maybe go on some walks in the evening and get yourself back in the gym. Maybe you need to find something new that you like. Maybe you don't enjoy just going to the gym and just lifting weights, or maybe what you really need is you need a new program, or you need to really look at maybe setting yourself a goal or having something for you to solely focus on so you can regain that motivation. The motivation will not always be there. So whoever's listening to this who's struggling with motivation, motivation is not always there. But if we have the discipline and we have the hard work, we will be absolutely fine. And next, we've got Lola. Lola asks, I've recently plucked up the courage to have a PT as I want to be in better shape for summer. However, I find they're more interested in making me skinny, as they are very critical of my eating habits and lifestyle choices. It makes me really insecure, not wanting to go to my sessions. What should I do? So, first of all, you need to have maybe done a little bit more research on your PT or your coach. Now, a PT is great for 1 hour of your week, if that's how often you're seeing them. But you aren't seeing them for the rest of the week. So, first of all, your main problem is that they're wanting to make you skinny. What is your physique goal, Lola? What do you want to look like? Not what your coach wants you to look like. What do you want to look like? Do you... Oh, I think we've got Alfie back. Alfie, hello. Can you hear me? Alfie, hello? No, I'm not sure. It looks better, but I don't know if you can hear me. Alfie, can you hear me? No.
Hey, mate, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me okay? No, there's still a very large delay. Yeah, there's still a large delay. So we're going to go back to the listener questions. So where was I with Lola? So basically, yeah, you need to look at a physique that you want to retain, Lola, and what you want. You know, a PT might want you to look skinny, but the main thing is what your goal is. So look at your eating habits and your lifestyle. They're not being overly critical, but some coaches are pretty cutthroat. Others are a little bit softer. So maybe if you're not wanting to go to your sessions, just tell the PT, you know, they can't keep your money if you've only attended 2 sessions. They should be giving you a refund unless there's a contract in place. So my biggest piece of advice for you is maybe do a little bit more shopping online, maybe look at an online coach, because they're a lot better for you. In my eyes, an online coach should support you for more hours than anything else. Right, we're going to try for one last time. We're going to see if Alfie is working. Alfie, can you hear me? Alfie, hello. Yeah, we're going to have to leave it, Alfie. Sorry, my friend. Right, guys, I apologize for that. Just some technical issues that happens. So, yeah, Lola, I would definitely say that that is what you need to do. You need to look around online. There needs to potentially be more communication with your PT and your coach. And we just need to, you know, you need to maybe look around and see what else there is for you to do and you to work with. Next, we've got Tom, who is asking, if I'm not eating a lot of meat right now, would protein shakes and powders be a good way to supplement my protein intake? Also, what are some good high calories, high protein foods that aren't meat? That is a fantastic question, Tom. So you've been eating, you're not eating a lot of meat, and you're like, so protein powders, first of all, are, if I had to grade the importance of a protein shake out of 10, I would probably say a 7 or an 8. They are fantastic, simple ways of getting in high protein, low calories, and just a simple way. It's it's in the name, okay? It's a supplement. If you're not eating meat or you don't like eating meat, then I would highly suggest a protein shake or yogurts or fish. But again, some people categorize meat as fish. I wouldn't. Meat is obviously your poultry and your red meats, and then your fish is obviously your fish. You want some good high calorie, high protein foods that aren't meat. So you've got tofu, you've got eggs, obviously, you've got protein bars, you've got nuts, which are very high calories, full of lots of essential fats. And there's probably a few other bits and bobs. Right, guys, so we are going to go on to a little new section called Article of the Week. Okay, so there is... There is an article at the moment that has come out that says just 35 minutes of exercise per week lowers the risks of dementia by 41%. 60% lower risk with 35 to 70 minutes per week.
63% lower risk with 70 to 140 minutes per week, and a 69% lower risk with 140 plus minutes a week. This is moderate to vigorous intensity of exercise. This can include brisk walking, jogging, running, cycling, swimming, sports, or recreational activities. Okay, this is something that I thought would be super interesting because I'm hearing lots about dementia at the moment and lots of issues. So we're looking at moderate to vigorous activity. Okay, so if you are a gym goer or you aren't a gym goer and you might have some hereditary dementia in the family or any sort of, you know, illness like this, exercise is definitely the one for you. Like I said, you're looking at, you could look at 30 minutes daily. You know, the results basically suggest that engaging in additional amounts of, you know, moderate to vigorous exercise reduces dementia, with the highest benefit appearing amongst individuals that have never done moderate to vigorous exercise. So if you don't exercise, you can basically get a lot more benefits from, you know, in just introducing exercise into your life. Okay, so that is going to be the article of the week. Now we've got some more listener questions. So we've got Holly asks, how much cardio should I have in my workout? Well, that largely depends on your goals, if I'm honest with you. So Holly, if your goal is to lose body fat or get leaner or you want to get fitter, they all completely depend. Okay, so let's start with, if you wanted to get cardiovascularly fitter, just doing more cardio is going to make you fitter. You're going to see some benefits in 6 to 8 weeks time. You might find that your time's getting quicker, or you're wanting to go for longer, or you're finding more enjoyment for it. So that would probably be if you want to get cardiovascular fitter. Now, if you want to use cardio for weight loss, or more importantly, fat loss, I would probably say to people anywhere between 20 and 60 minutes a couple of times a week. So maybe 2-3 times a week. I always say to people, walking is a form of cardio, but I think that is depending on how you're doing your walking. So there's a lot of people that say incline treadmill is great for fat loss. It really, really is. But at the end of the day, doing something and eating in a calorie deficit is going to really, really promote that. So remember, high protein, lots of steps, training for muscle mass building and not to create a calorie deficit, and then use your cardio to help with your calorie deficit. So I hope that helps. Jay asks, how to start doing pull-ups as a beginner if my gym doesn't have a dedicated machine? Jay, fantastic question. So there's a couple of ways you can do this. You can either use a band. So you wrap the band around the bar or the handles, and you put your feet or your knees through it, which should make it a lot easier for you when performing the chin up or the pull up. Okay, so it makes it lighter at the bottom, which is the hard part, and it makes it easier at the top when you have a smaller range of motion. You also have using a step or a box, so you can jump up and then you can hold down the negative part of the movement. So instead of doing eccentric concentric, so that's pulling and then letting go, or coming back, you can, the pulling part is the jump part, and then at the top you slowly decrease and you slowly let go of your body, which is a really good way of building some upper body strength and getting stronger at this exercise. And guys, coming up after this short break, we will be joined by Dr. Sam Watts, who is clinician of Ayurveda and author of The Ayurvedic Approach to Cancer.
FUBAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
You might then see friends, family that require a little bit of support, financial advice. How do you go about sharing that advice, sharing that support without being condescending?
A practical tip that everyone can do that is low friction: send them financial content that you like. If you have a favorite content creator, if you see an article that you like, send them the video and just ask them, what do you think? And then that can begin a conversation around it.
to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way from this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When is too early to say I love you? Soph said it the night we met.
Yeah. I did. Right, okay, right, let's just clear this up, right? When I said I love you, I remember I said it in the car.
In the cab, yeah.
In the cab, and I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah, well, that was the day I made you my girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I said I love you, and you were like, I love you too, and I was like, I love you, 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 I love you so much, I love you so much, oh my God, I love you.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
Follow us at What The Health Show for more with George. This is What The Health.
This is What The Health on FUBAR Radio with me, Georges Bertineau. Joining me now is Dr. Sam Watts, clinician of Ayurvedi and author of The Ayurvedic Approach to Cancer. Dr. Sam Watts, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. Enjoying the sun? Yep, I have indeed. I've been enjoying the sun and I'm very good. Thank you very much. Did you have a good weekend?
I did, thank you. Yeah, I did, thank you. Yeah, it's just funny, nice to be able to get outdoors, isn't it? And enjoy the weather. I feel like a long winter this year.
Yeah, I agree. I think we have. And then we know that the summer is going to be very short, knowing our luck. Right.
Very short.
Can you start by explaining what Ayurvedi actually is? And it's correct. I'm saying it correctly, right? Ayurvedi.
Yeah, well, there's a few ways. I mean, Ayurveda is kind of
Ayurveda.
The classical pronunciation. Okay. Yeah, but there's so many different ways of pronouncing it. So, I mean, Ayurveda is actually recognized officially as the oldest systematically practiced form of medicine in the world. It goes back, you know, over 5,000 years as a documented system of health. And it's such a broad area, but I think one of the perhaps the most simplest way of contextualizing what it is almost using the analogy of a car, in as much as if you drive a Mercedes and you have the service manual and the owner's manual of a Ford, it's not going to help you. It's a different car, it's a different engine, it's a different service requirement. Only helpful if you have the manual that's suitable to the car you're driving. And it's the same with our body. What's good for me as an individual in terms of my diet and my, you know, my self-care practices could actually be bad for someone else. Mm. So what Ayurveda does is it provides this kind of bespoke, customized service manual for how we optimize not health generically, but health for me or you as a given individual. And that's, you know, that's such a powerful modality, because if we look at Western healthcare at the moment and we look at the self-care and the public health movement, they're all stressing the same thing, which is individualized, personalized medicine. And that's what Ayurveda is. That's the founding tenet of what Ayurvedic medicine is. So it's very much about how we apply best evidence-based self-care, but for in an individualized way. And that's what it empowers us with.
Well, it's clearly popular and loved because it still exists, you know, 5,000 years later. You know, we have modern day medicine, but the fact that this is still, you know, popular and practiced shows that it clearly works.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think it has evolved a lot over those 5,000 years. And I think it's important to straddle both sides of that comment, in as much as we live in an evidence-based culture. You know, and in the West, when we're looking at Ayurveda as a preventative system of healthcare, but also an interventional one, it is important to emphasize that there is a very, very robust foundation of evidence to support not just that it does work, but how it works. You know, we just got to look at some of the Nobel Prize winning pieces of research over the last few years. You know, the Nobel Prize in 2018 was won for a piece of research on circadian biology. Mm-hmm. And that was what that was advocating was pretty much straight out of Ayurvedic medicine in terms of the importance of living with our circadian rhythm and maintaining circadian alignment. And, you know, we look at the dietary approaches and the herbal medicines, they have this robust foundation of published evidence to support them, and that's really important. But at the same time, if things don't work, they don't last in any context. And the fact that we have these practices that have evolved and survived for, you know, 5,000 years is a long time. And that's testament to the impact these practices have. And if you combine that traditional heritage and you dovetail it with the Western clinical research, I think what it gives is a very valid model for health promotion that slots beautifully, I think, into the Western, the general Western healthcare arena.
Well, that kind of leads me on to, you know, my next question, which is, how did you first get into researching this practice?
I was very fortunate in many ways, and I actually grew up with it. One of my family's closest friends and neighbour in my road was a Sri Lankan natural doctor. He was a conventional doctor, but he was trained in homeopathy and herbal medicine and Ayurveda. So we grew up immersed and, you know, in this world and in these practices. And he was, you know, he treated my family whenever we fell sick. He was who we turned to. So I grew up with it, and the older I got, the more interested I became. And then when I was working in cancer research, conventional cancer research in Southampton Hospital, a Western hospital, what I was seeing was that when we're looking at the research around how people maximize their quality of life, but also their quantity of life when living with cancer, what I was seeing was so much of the best practices were practices that Ayurveda talks about and advocates in slightly different ways, but the core was there. And then as that research evolved, what I began to see was that if you had a cohort of people living with cancer and they took the very best of conventional care whilst at the same time integrating evidence-based Ayurvedic practices, they began to thrive. Their side effect profiles reduced. The impact of their conventional treatments increased. Their energy, their sleep, their mood, their immune counts, a whole raft of variables. And that was the real light bulb moment for me, in that if we can create this model where people are taking the very best of Western anti-cancer medicine and combining it with the very best of the Ayurvedic approach to cancer care, what you get is a synergistic response where the total benefit is much greater than the sum of both parts.
Yeah.
And as I've used that over the years, I've just seen it become more and more effective. And it's needed now. It's needed now more than ever, with more and more people being diagnosed with cancer at a younger age.
Yeah.
We need to find new ways of helping people not just cope with cancer, but to thrive with it and to live healthier and longer lives. And Ayurveda has an important place to play in that objective.
Okay. And you mentioned that you're trained as a cancer researcher. How do you find that they overlap? So obviously you mentioned that they work well together. Is that how you think they overlap, like you mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of ways that they overlap. If we say one of the main areas of my interest, it's a real passion of mine, is understanding something called ECAPs, E-C-A-P, which is a clinical term for exceptional cancer patients. So these are individuals usually with a terminal prognosis. So they typically no more than about 12 to 15 months life expectancy.
Okay.
Very often they're not having conventional treatment because the side effects outweigh any potential benefit.
Okay.
And yet they somehow buck the trend, they beat the odds, and they're alive in 3, 5, 7, 10 years time, despite that being impossible. How did they achieve this? They're not common, but they're not rare either. And the theory is that if you can begin to identify commonalities, themes that all of these ECAPs do, then in theory, those commonalities should be predictive of what allowed them to become exceptional in the first place. And the more I began working with these ECAPs and the more I began researching them, what I began to see was that the variables that had the most predictive weight in what allowed them to become exceptional came straight out of the Ayurvedic frameworks.
Okay.
So that was, for me, that was the real turning point on this isn't just a complementary system that can help people feel better. There's an actual validity here in that these practices align in the same way as the Western research around what can help people actually live longer. It's not to say that Ayurveda is a cure for cancer. It's not as simple as that. But what it is saying is that it has practices that, you know, are predictive of reaching ECAP status. And those practices span everything from contemplative practices like meditation, contemplation, all the way through to the very powerful anti-cancer herbal medicines that have got very, very strong research behind them, to the dietary frameworks and so many others. So the overlap very much combined beautifully within this arena of exceptional cancer survivorship. And that's not to say that it's just suitable for people who have a stage 4 incurable cancer. If these models work in that more advanced stage, then they're probably going to be even more powerful and more impactful in people who've got cancer at a more localized and curable state. So, it doesn't matter whether you're trying to prevent cancer, whether you're trying to manage it, whether your diagnosis is stage 1 or stage 4, these practices have validity and they have evidence behind them.
Okay. And you recently released a book called The Ayurvedic Approach to Cancer, correct?
Yes.
Tell us more about this.
That book was a long time in the making, and it was for me about looking back over the last 15, 20 years of work in cancer research and Ayurvedic medicine, and particularly this very marginalized region of ECAPs, of exceptional cancer survivorship. And what I wanted to do was, I've had the real privilege, and it has been a privilege, of working and knowing so many of these ECAPs, these exceptional cancer patients, and seeing what they've achieved and essentially blowing the lid off the idea of impossible. For me, it was about how do we inspire and empower as many people with cancer as possible to aim and reach for that same objective. And you can't do that in one-to-one care. You can't do that in one-to-one patient care. You can do it, but it's not an efficient way of spreading that message that this model of exceptional cancer survivorship is there. It's there for everyone. It's not to say that everyone with terminal cancer can survive, but it is to say that everyone has the potential to.
Yes.
And what I wanted to do was essentially consolidate all of that work and research over the last 15, 20 years and try to condense it down into a unified model, a unified framework of what, in my experience, is the most effective way of optimizing survivorship when you're living with cancer in an evidence-based, multifactorial way, whilst at the same time aligning that with the practices that are most predictive of exceptional cancer survivorship. And that's what the book is about. It's about that consolidated model. So it's packed into one place, everything I think we need to know around those objectives into one framework.
Okay. So you've made it a lot more condensed. So, because obviously I'm sure there's so much information out there, and you've condensed everything down into a format that you feel is best.
Yeah, and something that you can pick up and run with if you're if your mother or your granny or a friend has been recently diagnosed with cancer and you know nothing about the world of integrative medicine or natural medicine or Ayurveda and anything about any of it, you could hopefully, the aim is that you could pick up that book, you could read it, and you could adopt the practices overnight. You don't need any prior knowledge, you don't need any prior understanding. It's there in a practical, applicable framework. It's left out the things that are still maybe useful in some context, but not predictive, not that valuable. And it's just focused on the variables that are most powerful, that have the most evidence behind them. It was just, for me, a tool for empowering what I want to be, you know, a bit of a paradigm change. And I think a big part of that is the mindset. You know, there's so much, rightly so, there's so much fear around cancer. And we know from the research that fear can create almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Around side effects and all kinds of variables. And that what I want the book to be is a tool for ultimately for recontextualizing cancer as something that we have a profound ability to impact upon through our own choices and our own behaviors and our own lifestyle practices. And again, that's what the book is trying to facilitate.
Okay. Well, what would you say the most interesting thing you discovered whilst writing the book was?
In terms of the content of the book, do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. The most powerful part of the book, and it's one that people are always surprised about, because when people think about cancer survivorship, I think the first thing they think of are the very practical, most prescriptive practices like dietary medicine and herbal medicine. But if we look at the research, and it's why the book starts with this, the single most powerful predictor of what allows someone to become an ECAP, to become an exceptional cancer patient, is the genuine belief that they can do it. And that's consistent across pretty much all of the research, not just within cancer, but within most life-limiting or life-threatening diseases. And there's some phenomenal, incredibly complex research that's evolved from the early 1980s all the way through to today, showing the actual neurochemical and biological mechanisms by which a very strong belief, how that alters physiology in the direction of that belief. When it comes down to things like neuropeptides, immune modulators, which are the actual biochemical pathways of mind-body medicine, of mind over matter in many ways. And every single ECAP, every single exceptional cancer patient I've ever met, ever researched, ever worked with, has had that overwhelming, all-consuming belief that they could survive. And it's a learned skill. Some people cultivate that more easily than others, but everyone can cultivate it. And it's important, because when there's bombs going off around you, when someone looks you in the eyes and said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Bloggs, you know, the scans have come back, there's not much more we can do, and you've got 12 months to live." It's very, 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 very easy, understandably, for that to become your all-consuming, overwhelming reality.
Yeah.
And what these ECAPs do is they somehow turn inward and they say, I respect your opinion and I respect your statistics, but I choose my own reality. And that reality is that in 10 years, I'm going to be here. I'm going to be here fit and well. And this is how I'm going to make that happen. And they turn inwards and they unleash this overwhelming array of tools and techniques and practices that help them to facilitate that.
Yeah.
But if you're radicalizing your diet and you're taking the best of conventional medicine and you're using the herbal practices, if you're doing all those things, but that inner whisper in your mind is that actually it's pointless. What's the point? I'm not going to survive. I'm not going to be here in, 12 months' time. All those things are never going to unleash the same healing pathways, because the body is essentially telling itself, this is a pointless exercise. I'm going to be dead in a year.
Yeah.
So what we need is both. We need all of the practices that are predictive of better survivorship, whilst at the same time using those in a body and in a mind and a brain and a neurochemical system that says I can survive. And that to me will always be the linchpin of exceptional cancer survivorship, because I think without it, there's a much lower ceiling of what can be achieved.
I don't mean to interrupt you. We are going to run out of time, sadly. I just want to thank you so much. You've been amazing. Have a great rest of your day, okay? I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, No, mind. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Guys, as always, thank you to the guests. You guys can catch us on Ooga podcasting platforms. We are back next week at 11 a.m. for another jam-packed show. Thank you once again. I'm Georges. Goodbye.